Welcome to The Classical Mind, a podcast about the great books in the Western canon. We're your hosts. I'm Father Wesley Walker.
And I'm Dr. Junius Johnson.
Junius, it's been a while since we've been able to record. We have had illnesses and traveling and all that in between. Did you have a good Easter?
Yeah, this is a wonderful Easter. You know, yeah, we've had eclipses and dogs and cats living together. It's been a crazy, crazy world, but we're all recovered over here, and we had a good Easter celebration and are keeping Eastertide rolling.
Excellent. Excellent. That's right. Eastertide is a season, not a day. So we get to party quite a bit. It's good. Well, we are here today to talk about a Jane Austen novel. And if I remember correctly, in our draft of season two books, this was one of my picks.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, that feels so long ago now, but I think I picked this because I asked my wife, what's a book or two that you think we should cover on Classical Mind? And she's like, oh, have you read Emma? And I said, no. And she said, oh, you should add that. And I have given her no short amount of grief for that over the past couple weeks. So I guess we could always start by talking about kind of our experience with the text. So Junius, when did you first sort of encounter Emma?
So I actually encountered it first, Heresy of Heresies, through the Gwyneth Paltrow movie that came out when I was in college. I didn't know the story before that. And so I watched the movie, really enjoyed it, and then went back and read the book afterwards.
Interesting. Interesting. How long, like, was it the kind of thing where you saw the movie and you were like, oh, I got to read the book? Or was it a couple years or something?
It was pretty immediate because I was still, I definitely was still in college. I kind of felt like I couldn't. Even though I don't think we were assigned any Jane Austen in any of my lit classes, I didn't feel like I could graduate as an English major without having read some Austen. So I knocked out Emma first. And yeah, I think it was probably within a few months of seeing the movie.
That's interesting. So this was your first Jane Austen novel. You had not read Pride and Prejudice first.
That's right. Yeah.
Huh. Very interesting. I wonder how that might shape one's approach to the text if it's their first Jane Austen read versus having already read Pride and Prejudice. I would imagine that you're sort of an exception here, that most people would have read Pride and Prejudice first. That's certainly my experience. I read it in high school and enjoyed Pride and Prejudice quite a bit, but I had not read Emma until we had to read it for this. In fact, I think we have like two or three books in a row where I had not had really any experience with them before.
Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of enjoy, you know, getting to go back and pick these books up. But I will say that upon my first read, and you know this because I texted you about it, I really was not enjoying it. I was not having a good time. I finished it, and then when I watched the movie, the 2020 movie with Anya Taylor-Joy, I began to appreciate it a little more. And I guess maybe as I let it marinate a little bit more, I came around to it. And I'm not alone. There's a local pastor here in the Annapolis, Maryland area, Pastor Brett. So shout out to him. And he and I meet up for coffee every so often. And he loves to read. He's a great, voracious reader. And he started giving me a hard time for picking this book. He was like, I love all the books we've read, but this one I'm having a real tough time.
Well, so I think it would be really good for you to say a bit more about what it was that you disliked about it upon a first reading.
Well, I think I went into this expecting Pride and Prejudice or something like Pride and Prejudice. And I think that Emma is in a different genre than Pride and Prejudice is. So Pride and Prejudice is a novel of manners. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly funny parts in the novel. Mm-hmm. You can think of like Mrs. Bennet and the way her and Mr. Bennet relate to each other. They are funny. Mm-hmm. But overall, I wouldn't necessarily call Pride and Prejudice a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Emma is a comedy of manners, so it is explicitly supposed to be a funny book. You know, mm-hmm. it is a satirical exploration to critique social conventions, especially those of kind of the high society, the aristocracy of Austen's time.
Mm-hmm.
And this genre goes back. I mean, this is a quite common genre. Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest, for example, is a comedy of manners, mm-hmm. kind of mocking Victorian double standards regarding sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Austen is doing in this novel, and this helped me appreciate it when I realized this, is that there was a genre that had arisen kind of in her day called sentimental novels, which were sappy. They were also called novels of sensibility. they were designed almost purely to elicit an emotional response. I mean, this is kind of romanticism, right? You know, a purely emotional response. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of our prior authors has a novel that was kind of an important work in the genre. And it might be someone who's kind of unexpected. Any guess who contributed to the novel of sensibility genre that we've read in this season?
No.
Jean-Jacques Rousseau's New Heloise.
That's right.
Is considered a very important work.
I have not read that.
So then Emma is kind of a reaction to it, to that genre, that kind of sentimentality, emotionalism. And it's very clearly, I think, a comedy of manners. Once you realize that's what she's doing, it makes a lot of sense. Like Emma's privilege, making her blind to her friend Harriet's real needs and situation. Her privilege makes her unable to finish anything. We can also see it in her father's hypochondria and her need to be a matchmaker. All the result of sort of having nothing really to do of any value. We can see it in the way Frank Churchill goes all the way to London to get a haircut. You know, it's kind of a excessive, decadent thing. And so Austin is kind of poking fun at that privilege and also, I think, critiquing class disparity, right? I mean, the way that Emma sees all these people of lower class than her is like, you know, purely to relate to them as charity cases so that she can feel better.
Mm.
Rather than seeing them as people.
Mm-hmm.
Her disapproval of Mr. Martin, who is a tenant farmer. So her problem with him isn't that he's poor. It's mm-hmm. that he's middle class. You know, he has to work for his money. So he's not low enough for her charity, but he's not high enough for her acquaintance, she says.
Yeah, that's right.
So you get a lot of these kind of things going on. So once you become aware that that's what's going on in the text, hopefully that makes it more enjoyable. And I think it also helps with the characters. I think Pride and Prejudice, the characters are more real.
Mm-hmm.
And in this novel, the characters are satire almost, you know, they are caricatures. So it's like watching The Office is funny because you can kind of connect characters to real people, but you know, like there are no real people like Dwight Schrute working in an office in America, really, in most places.
Oh, if only it were true.
Right. There are no bosses who are maximally Michael Scott, even though there might be bosses that have aspects of them. So I think that's the difference, right? Is that, you know, Emma's not a real person. I think she's a caricature of a kind of person.
You know, it's funny. I've always thought this novel incredibly funny. And I felt that, I remember when I picked it up again for this time around, because I did reread it, it was two things struck me right away and they were related. The first thing was I was reminded how incredibly great a master of her language Jane Austen is. Mm. You know, the sentences just roll with a kind of inexorability that is just fantastic. And then the way that she deploys that to paint Emma and those around her in tones of either understatement or contrariety or even hyperbole, which is really quite amazing. So here's an example just from the first chapter. I'll just read a little bit of this. Let's see. The real evils, indeed, of Emma's situation were the power of having rather too much her own way and a disposition to think a little too well of herself. These were the disadvantages which threatened alloy to her many enjoyments. It's a really masterful thing, right? You expect these evils to be proper evils, and she uses all the language of evils and disadvantages that you would expect of serious defects in either character or situation. But then she fills the spot up, the predicate, with, you know, she's got too much, she gets her own way too much, and she thinks too highly of herself. And it's a wonderful, it sets the stage wonderfully for our understanding the impending disaster that's coming that, you know, fortunately doesn't actually ensue. But Emma ought to have wrecked half a dozen lives over the course of this story. And it's only by the, you know, events that are entirely outside of her doing her machinations at all that doesn't wind up being the case.
That's right. She's sort of saved by the bell.
Yeah.
in some ways. Yeah. So perhaps, I guess, oh, go ahead.
Well, one of the things on this notion of sentimental novels, you know, the novel mentioned in the novel is The Mysteries of Udolpho, which by Anne Radcliffe, who was one of the great Gothic novel writers, and of whom our next author, Sir Walter Scott, was also, who partook of that as well. The Bride of Lammermoor is a wonderful Gothic novel that Walter Scott wrote. And the Gothic novel was the other genre of pulp fiction of the day, as it were, the other really popular. So you had these novels of sensibility and romance and whatnot. On the other hand, you had these Gothic novels. And it's interesting that, you know, the connection between, typically you would think of the guys reading the Gothic novels more and the girls reading the sensational novels. And so the way that the, sorry, she mentioned Mysteries of Udolpho. She mentioned the other one, the forest one. What was it called?
I don't recall.
Well, anyway, it's another Anne Radcliffe novel. That's a bit at play here as well. Jane Austen is situating Emma a little bit in relation to these other novels, both of these two genres, the one that her novel is mimicking and the one that her novel would be competing with on the shelves, right? And I think another part of what's challenging about coming to Emma is that the title doesn't help you very much, right?
That's true.
Because with Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility, you kind of know what you're in for right at the beginning. And you kind of get this theme all the way from the very beginning of the novel. Okay, so are you Pride or are you Prejudice, right? And you can kind of read the characters along that way. With Emma, all you know is pay attention to this one character.
Yeah.
And she's painted in terms that make her seem like a victim, when in fact the thing she's a victim of is her own bad character, frankly. I won't say evil character, that's too strong.
No.
But her own bad character, right? And her own willingness to feel that she ought to have power over the lives of others, which is externally reinforced by the fact that she's the most important person around, right? Everyone in the village has to look up to Emma. She's the great lady sort of dominating this whole thing in the Catholic de Bourg type position for the time of Highbury. And so there's a kind of a twisted noblesse oblige that drives Emma, interpreted not by what's actually good for those under her, but by what will let her feel good about the way that she cares for those under her, as it were.
So for this reason, would you say that Emma's flaw is pride? I mean, is that what we're looking at then?
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, actually, I kind of feel like she has both of the P's. She's got Pride and Prejudice. They both get united in her. And I think the fact that Prejudice might actually help to mitigate some of her pride, right? Her pride is not as thoroughly destructive as you might think, in part because her prejudice keeps her from being really ruthless about applying it. There are a whole class of people who are below her level of notice. And then there's also just whole situations that she feels, well, that's nothing to do with me. And so I can safely ignore that, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think in some ways her pride is tied to a system of class, right? So I think in our world, because we have sort of a radical individualism, you know, pride is often anchored purely in a misestimation of the self. I have all these abilities, I have all this charisma, I have whatever, you know, that I need. Emma's pride does seem to come from the fact that she is of a high class, which is still pride. It's just not, I think the foundation of that pride is in something kind of almost higher than herself. And so, yeah, there are certain decorum she still has to follow because of that. So she's not, perhaps, like you said, she's not evil in that regard. Even though she does make some pretty unwise and cruel at times.
Yeah, I think cruel is good. And at the same time, I mean, yes to everything you're saying. And yet there is also another source of her pride. There's more than one source, right? The other source is the fact that she's so accomplished. She's proud of her accomplishments, and she feels that it's incumbent upon her to put her abilities and skills to use for the good of the people around her. And so it makes her prone to play the matchmaker and to adopt lost puppies. I mean, young girls and that sort of a thing in order to, and you know, from her perspective, you can see how what she's doing for Jane is this incredibly kind and helpful, you know, giving, showing her the ropes and sort of, you know, overcoming the disadvantages of not knowing who her parents are and this sort of a thing. But at the end of the day, it's quite, you know, quite destructive because she doesn't really understand what real relationships and real people are like.
That's true. I suppose what I was, my impression of Emma from the book is that she is not necessarily accomplished, that she has a pretense to accomplishment because everyone around her is sort of, except for Mr. Knightley, is sort of a yes man.
Yes.
So her paintings, paintings are great. She even says the best paintings are the ones that she hasn't done as much work on because they're still the most potential in them. Right. And so everybody is so excited, you know, when she does something, but it's really that they're paying homage to her office or class more than they are really to anything specific she actually does.
Mm-hmm.
And so she thinks she's accomplished. And I think this is one of Mr. Knightley's critiques of her kind of early on is like, well, you think that you've done so well, but like mm-hmm. you haven't really done a whole lot of real substance.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the things you're giving yourself credit for, those things happen on their own. Like you're not responsible for the wedding that they just kind of get together on their own. Right. And she's like, oh no, well, you know, I did this thing. It's not so much. I said, Jane earlier, I meant Harriet, of course.
That's right. That's right.
Adopts. Yeah.
So,
yeah. So, I mean, I think it goes back to that sentence that I read. Then there's a misestimation of self that grounds all of this.
Yes.
And so there's always the, what Emma thinks about Emma and then what's true about Emma. And often the most reliable entry into who what Emma's really like, a proper estimation of Emma, tends to be Mr. Knightley.
Yes.
Who alone is who's neither a yes man to her nor is infatuated with her in the manner of a father or a potential husband like Mr. Elton.
That's right. That's right. He sees her for who she is, which is why he ends up with her. And I think that that's where this is not a novel of sensibility or a kind of overly romanticized, you know, novel, because he's willing to see her for all her flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And so being married to an Emma must be hard, you know, because because there are very real flaws, but every marriage is hard for that reason, right? I mean, we go into it knowing or hopefully knowing the flaws and the strengths of our partners, and you know, we're signing up in order to put up with those. So there's no doubt that, you know, had Mr. Elton married Emma, he would have been, I think, blinded to those flaws.
Yeah. I think he would have very quickly become miserable. Even Mr. Knightley, I think I was going to talk about poor Mr. Martin. But I there's a sense in which I can say poor Mr. Knightley too, because I don't have a lot of hope that Emma's going to get much better. I don't feel like she's learned something through the course of the novel, I think, right? I mean, she was allowed to experience at least the possibility of very real consequences. And she was embarrassed by the whole Frank Churchill escapade. But at the end, I think that the problem with Mr. Knightley is that he has always been there for her in the midst of all of her flaws before. And so there's not really any real sense that she needs to change to be worthy of him or something like that. She can almost take him for granted, as it were. I can imagine them turning into a couple that where their interactions in, you know, a putative novel where they're now the parents and their young daughter is the main character, where their interactions are funny for us as readers, but kind of painful if you think about what that represents or the actual life together underneath. I hope for Mr. Knightley's case that's not so, but I don't have a lot of hope for her learning a lot from this experience.
Yeah, that's fair. This is the only hope that she has, though, I think, because he is willing to call her out when she needs to be, which is exactly right. I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of person you do want in a spouse. I mean, not someone who's overly critical or unduly critical, but someone who is willing to say that, you know, well, this was wrong, or you shouldn't have done this, or whatever, reprimand you when you are wrong in a redeeming way, you know, because you see the potential of the person. And yeah. I do think Mr. Knightley sees the potential in her, based on some of their interactions. I mean, he's not trying to be mean, you know. So it is very interesting.
I think that's quite right. And also the other half of what makes him good for her is that she's willing to let him critique her, which is the other hard thing, right? It's one thing we all need someone who can call us on our stuff, but it's another thing to allow that person to do that job. And I think, you know, Emma has shown that she's willing to allow him to do that.
Yes. So then what is it that Mr. Knightley gets from Emma?
I suspect that Emma's about his only something like intellectual equal among the people at offer, right? The other possible candidates are fairly silly. And while I wouldn't, you know, Emma's no great deep thinker, she does have a quick wit. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Knightley very much enjoys sparring verbally with her. He clearly finds her very attractive. That comes up several times. So I think she's a good companion for him because they can do a really good dance together.
Yeah, no, I gather that too. And also she's kind of a, and at times unduly so, but she is kind of an optimist. Mm-hmm. And he strikes me as maybe more of a pessimist, you know? And I do think there is a kind of opposites attract in this regard. You know, she's always ready to go on some crazy plan, you know, to fix these two up or do this or do that. And he's kind of always grounding her. But I do think someone who has that tendency to ground needs maybe a little more spontaneity, a little more of a kind of maybe not spontaneity, but that kind of life that she brings, I think is good for him.
Yeah, and it also it's kind of good for Highbury in the sense that it combines the two most important personages of the area, you know, and so now there's this sense of all of that reference can be joined into one household. I was trying to remember. We aren't told what happens with poor Mr. Woldhouse at the end, are we?
I don't think so.
What's he gonna do? Presumably, they're gonna go live at Knightley's place, and I mean, people only really ever came over because of Emma's doing. So I wonder how poor old Papa's gonna get along.
That's true. Well, he's got so much more time to worry about his health now.
There you go.
I'm sure he'll take lots of walks or not walks, depending on
the weather. Short, very, very, very short walks.
That's right. Yes, he certainly won't be going to the beach.
Yeah, and he's another funny character too, right? I mean, this he's very much the poor old father who's useless for much of anything, and you know, it frees him up to have all of his world be Emma, except that he doesn't spend that much time thinking about Emma for all that she's all that he has, right?
Yes.
And so it's this. I think the big vice that shines at me from these pages is the vice of leisure. Right. They have nothing. They need do nothing because their income is guaranteed from the land and the work that essentially the folks in the town are supplying the wealth of the higher class through their own labor. And they also don't have any meaningful employ to spend their time about. And so they can truly do whatever they want. And Emma's frankly super bored at the beginning of this thing. And that's what's causing her to meddle in everyone's lives. And it's the same thing with her father. He doesn't have anything to do. And he's not the kind of person who's, you know, going to gather a lot of society around himself or whatever. So he just sort of sits around all day.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Leisure is. Well, and it's that combination, I think, of things too, right? It's not only that they have the opportunity for leisure, it's that their privilege makes that leisure, boring. So Emma could be a good musician, but she just doesn't. I mean, it's like she doesn't put the effort into anything because why would she need to? So she lacks certain, I guess she lacks maybe another flaw is she lacks fortitude.
And I think that's related to the class thing as well, because my sense of at least the way these things get painted in these novels, I'm not sure how historically accurate it is, but the way that the upper class gets painted is that it is encouraged that a lady be accomplished, but it is not encouraged that she be especially good at anything, right? You don't want to become a virtuoso musician. You want to be a competent musician. And so there's kind of a social pressure to dabble and be a bit of a jack of all trades.
Yeah. I suppose this is an extension of like a Renaissance man or a, you know, well-rounded person. But the problem with Emma is she gets super jealous of people who are good at something. Like, mm-hmm. she's not crazy about Jane Fairfax being such a great musician, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Turns out she's quite right to be concerned about Jane Fairfax.
Well, that's true. That's true. It's not all unduly concerned, but still, you know, you do get the feeling she's jealous of her ability to play. Mm-hmm. When she does the picture of Harriet, I mean, she really does. She is really looking for, I think, praise. Mm-hmm. And it's passable. I mean, it's not that it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not great.
Yeah, that's right. Only the eyes of love could see it as more than average.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Now, can we talk about the elephant in the room?
Which one?
You. You are, if I understand correctly, in fact, a priest in the Anglican tradition.
Yes.
So you're as close to Mr. Elton as we've got here.
Yes.
So, you know, why don't you talk to us a little bit from that perspective?
Absolutely. So it's very interesting, isn't it, the way Mr. Elton and really Jane Austen can be fairly critical of Anglican clergy, I think, mm-hmm. in all of her novels. You think about, I forgot his name in Pride and Prejudice, but the priest in Pride and Prejudice is also
so silly.
He's yeah. silly, right? He's silly. And I think in many ways she's picking up on one of the great problems with the Anglican tradition. And I don't want to get into it too much, but Anglicanism is, you know, a state church, and it was created, I think, as a way of maintaining, you know, state control over the religion of England. Mm. And what comes with that, sort of the disadvantage that comes with that, is that you get a lot of cultural Christianity, but not necessarily real Christianity. And so I think this is what Jane Austen's doing. She was a very religious person. It's not that mm-hmm. she's anti-religion. In fact, quite the opposite, right? So you get these vicars of cures that were basically paid for, right? So the mm-hmm. you know, you get a house, you get a stipend that is, you know, pretty sizable. Being a clergy in this era was sort of a social status thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So and that's an important thing that I think is a really important aspect of all of these priest characters you're talking about, is that they are they're trying to find a position in society where everyone else has a hereditary position because of their nobility. Mm-hmm. And these priests don't have that, but they've been grafted in.
Yes. Which makes Emma's critique of the tenant farmers interesting in light of the fact that she does accept Mr. Elton socially.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
He annoys her sometimes, but like she seems to overlook that because of his social status. But like mm-hmm. in effect, he is in a kind of merit-based system yeah. like yeah. the tenant farmers are in as well. The only difference is he's picked, you know, a fair and there's a lot going on there politically and economically. You know, I mean, a wealthy family would often send their second son into the church. Mm-hmm. And this goes back before England. This is, I mean, even medieval Catholicism, right? The priests mm-hmm. were often, or bishops were often, second sons of wealthy families. Mm-hmm. They just didn't know what else to do with them. And I think it took off some of the pressure. You know, you send your kid to the church and maybe he won't assassinate his older brother so that he can take the estate. But no, Mr. Elton poses a couple problems throughout the novel, in my opinion, which is that he is a social climber. And so he sees his singleness as a way to acquire even more status.
Yes. Yes.
And so he Mr. Knightley even mentions as much, that he's not going to settle for someone who's of a lower class because he sees this as an opportunity to move up a rung yep. in the social ladder. And so, you know, the Eastern Orthodox have a rule where a man who becomes a priest is allowed to be married before he becomes a priest. Mm-hmm. But once he's married, once he becomes a priest, there is no marriage. So
that's
if he's
right.
single when he gets ordained, he stays single. If his wife passes away before him, he stays single. There's no dating
yeah.
allowed. There's no marriage allowed once you become a priest. And I do think Mr. Elton's a great cautionary tale about why this should be the case. Not only is there the fact that he's dating or trying to date a parishioner of his, mm-hmm. which, mm-hmm. you know, they wouldn't have called him father because they were still in a very Protestant phase in England. But still, there's a kind of almost spiritually incestuous thing about that, right? Going mm-hmm. after a woman in your parish who you are her spiritual father. But then when it doesn't work out with both him, with both Emma and Harriet, he now has to be the minister to these two women.
That's right. He appreciates at their weddings.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember if this happens in the book, but in the movie, she transcribes his sermons.
Mm-hmm.
And when it doesn't work out, she like throws them out the carriage into the pond. And it's like, well, you know, that just shouldn't be how you're relating to your minister.
Yeah.
As this eligible bachelor. Because all the young ladies, oh yeah, we love his preaching. Well, no, you think he's attractive and you want to get with him. That's why you think his preaching is great, you know? So I think there's a lot going on there. I mean, I think it's a critique of kind of cultural Christianity. Mr. Elton has nothing better to do than kind of worry about climbing the social ladder rather than actually save souls, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then also there's the complexities that come with a minister who is looking to be married, a young man who wants to date. Mm-hmm. So much damage could have been done in the parish, you know.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they had, I guess, other social pressures that probably would have maybe minimized the damage, but it's still not a good look, is it?
Yeah, that's right. You know, you mentioned the idea of sending a second son into the clergy and whatnot. And, you know, part of the reason for that, you know, wasn't just to get rid of the second son and to avoid assassinations and whatnot, but it was a legitimate path to power.
Yeah.
If you could, you know, one of the reasons why Thomas Aquinas' parents did not want his father anyway, did not want him to join the Dominicans was because their family had historically held the abbacy of Monte Cassino.
Right.
And so he could have become the abbot of Monte Cassino, which is, you know, Benedict's monastery, one of the most important monasteries in Italy. And that was a significant point of power for the family. But if Aquinas was not to do so, then it would pass out of the Aquinas family to someone else. And so there's this funny thing when you start doing your ladders of feudalism in the Middle Ages, where technically the ecclesiastical officials shouldn't be on the ladder of feudalism. There should be or at the very least, it should be a parallel separate ladder where the Duke owes fealty to the King, but the Archbishop owes fealty to the Pope. And that's kind of where it should stop. But that gets really muddy very early on, especially from the times of Charlemagne forward, where you've got popes who are subjects of the emperors and yet Pope. And then you get these treatises where there's this question of, well, you know, you have to obey imperial command because you are an imperial subject. Well, no, I don't, because I'm a spiritual authority over the, and so he should obey my commands and whatnot. And so that what that bequeaths to England, even at this late date and time, is this sense of honorific about the clergy, that being a clergyman is a way, there's a parallel social ladder, but also it's interwoven with the main social ladder. And so it does make a parish priest who has really nothing more to recommend him over the tenant farmer actually worthy of being included in the gatherings of the social elites where the tenant farmer would not be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's further complicated, I think, by the relationship between church and state in England at this time. Right. So like you say, there's this separate ladder, right? Lord to King, but in England, church and state get collapsed.
Yeah.
So now ministers are in some ways agents of the state.
That's right. The king's the head of the church.
That's right. King's the head of the church. So there's that, I think, further obscures what the ministry is actually supposed to be about, mm-hmm. because you do get it tangled up. And it's not until the Oxford movement, of which I am a great fan, and our modern bishops are recipients of much of that movement, where, you know, some of the priests in England were like, hey, wait a second, we're supposed to do so much more than just be, you know, agents of the state and go along with whatever Parliament tells us to do. We're the church, you know, we have our own kind of charism and our own vocation. And it's not just to support the state apparatus. If anything, the opposite, you know, the state mm-hmm. apparatus should be supporting us. And so, yeah, you run into all these kind of fault lines in Mr. Elton, who is over the course of the novel becomes really quite insufferable and unlikable, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like the least important thing about his identity in the book is that he's a priest.
Yeah,
right? Like everything else about him is more important than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, very, very Victorian English priest at that. Yes, he's ineffectual, I think is the word I would use to describe him overall. Yeah. Or even impotent, you know, in terms of his ministry. And but also that bleeds into then his personal life where he can't even really make his intentions clear, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the last bit of the novel touches a bit upon this, right? It's the last two paragraphs. The result of this distress, the poultry thieving, was that with a much more voluntary, cheerful consent than his daughter had ever presumed to hope for at the moment, she was able to fix her wedding day. And Mr. Elton was called on within a month from the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Martin to join the hands of Mr. Knightley and Miss Wodehouse. The wedding was very much like other weddings, where the parties have no taste for finery and parade. And Mrs. Elton, from the particulars detailed by her husband, thought it all extremely shabby and very inferior to her own. Very little white satin, very few lace veils, the most pitiful business. Selina would stare when she heard of it. But in spite of these deficiencies, the wishes, hopes, the confidence, the predictions of the small band of true friends who witnessed the ceremony were fully answered in the perfect happiness of the union. Mm. Right? And it's even though it's ending on a they live happily ever after, before that, you get the, yes, so Mr. Elton's going to come and marry the woman he wanted to marry to someone else. And the wedding, what can I say about the wedding? It was a wedding.
Which is very much the temperature of Anglicanism in that day, right? It was it was boring, you know, yeah. And kind of intentionally so, because if the church is an arm of the state, you don't want to upset things. Yeah. You want to be very moderate. So yeah. You read the 39 articles of the Church of England, and they have to carve out a space so that we're not Roman Catholic, we're not Anabaptist, but they basically allow everything in between.
That's right.
So they're not really a theological document. They're a political compromise document.
Yes.
And so everything about public worship in England was that, oh, well, we want to be historical and traditional, but we want to make sure that we're not, you know, too Catholic. We don't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm. So, it's fascinating to me that Mr. Knightley doesn't surprise me at all, but that Emma has no taste, I think, not in the sense of discerning palate, but interest in all the fineries and whatnot that would make a wedding that would be impressive to folks, right? I mean, it's a small number of people. It's a business-like affair. We're getting this thing done. My goal is to marry Mr. Knightley, not to put on a show. And so it shows the distinction between her and the eventual Mrs. Elton. And I think it also shows that Mr. Elton wound up with the right woman for him, because Mr. Elton, I think, does care very much about those sorts of things. And he would want his wedding to have been talked about for, you know, years to come and that sort of thing.
I'm going to have stickers made based on what you just said. Anglicanism, it's a business matter. But no, I think you're right. He's a climber. He's got aspirations. He's very vain. And so he marries someone who certainly reflects that. Maybe at times it's too much. Like Mr. Knightley says, you know, Emma did pick better for him than he did for his own self. But
right.
That's what happens when you're blinded by ambition and the desire to social climb.
Yeah. Well, I like to say something about the happy couple then. The one couple that I can unreservedly say is happy in the story, which is Harriet and Mr. Martin, because they were on the path to a truly happy union of love before Emma started fiddling around. And, you know, poor Mr. Martin, it's all, it must have been so blindsided, right? Like things were going so well. And she'd spent the summer with them and she liked his family and all this other kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, just out of the blue, total shutdown. Right. But, they do eventually wind up together. And it's such a good fit. And one of the feelings of joy I have at the end of the novel is that Harriet recognized in time what was really important and decided on the basis of that and not the nonsense Emma was pouring into her head.
Yes. 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 Her being rejected by Mr. Elton is the best thing that happens to her for sure. Mm-hmm. I think had it worked out with Mr. Elton, if he was able to, for some reason, overlook the disparity, she wouldn't be the right person to social climb with, because she's not very witty and she's not very aware. And so for her to go with the direction she does, I think it makes it much more there's a kind of telos there, right?
Yeah.
It's, she fits.
Yeah. And I don't remember who plays her in the newer movie, but who was it? Do you remember?
I don't remember her name, but her face is very much in my head right now.
Was she lovely?
She was not the most attractive of the characters.
Right. In the Gwyneth Paltrow, she's quite plain. Even to the point of, you know, you wouldn't call her attractive. And I think she's just, I don't think it's personal taste. She's done up that way. She's done up to seeing quite plain. In the novel, she's meant to be very pretty. That's actually one of the main things that recommends her to Emma, is that she's very, very pretty.
Yes.
And so it's strange to me that we don't go for that in the movies. We feel the need to downplay that. Right. But
yeah,
that was kind of her chief advantage, was that she was very pretty and possibly of a good class. Although Mr. Knightley calls it out, like, all logic is that she would not be. Right. Or that if she were, it's no advantage to her, that she's probably a bastard at best, right?
And doesn't her father end up being sort of a merchant, middle class type?
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So she's the exact class that Emma says she doesn't have any real charity for, and isn't high enough to be her acquaintance.
Yeah, that's right. Neither low enough nor high enough to be in Emma's regard there. That's right. And so she, you know, when Emma sees her, she sees the pretty face and she thinks, what she sees is, she sees a lump of clay, right? This is Emma. Oh, this is a good connection. Emma's Pygmalion, right? So she wants to mold this person. And so she sees beautiful raw material that she could shape up into someone that she would be excited to go around telling everybody, look at all the good that I did for Harriet, who was a nobody, and I made her somebody and found her a good match and secured her a place in society and all this other sort of thing. She doesn't actually see the girl. And I think that's really central to her ability to so consistently choose contrary to Harriet's actual good.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. For Emma, it's kind of a tabula rasa. That's how she sees her. Yeah. And that's kind of how she is. I mean, she is impressionable, you know?
Yeah. She soaks it all up, you know, and she doesn't want to do. She goes to Emma to ask, what should I do? And Mr. Martin proposes, and Emma's like, oh, I would never want to tell you what to do, but surely you're not thinking of accepting.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah. I won't influence the decision, but I'm also making my disapproval very obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important, too. You know, it's because if Emma's whole world runs on appearance. And so she has to get the appearances right, because if she doesn't, the cataclysm that awaits her if she doesn't get the appearance right is that she'll have to admit what a silly thing she is at the end of the day, right? She'll have to see herself truly. And for that reason, all of these things, it's not just a dance. It's not just a rhetorical trick. This is actually, you know, life and death self-preservation for her. And that's what Mr. Knightley is able to do, is to break through and show her just how far from who she thinks she is, she really is. And that's the foundation upon which a real change can be established.
I wonder, there's a character in the novel who I think plays a big part, but she's not talked about very much. And it's Emma's mother.
Mm.
Because I think that a lot of Emma's silliness could have been fixed with having a mother tell her, no, you don't do that.
Yeah.
Or explaining the whys, you know, well, this is why we help people, or this is why we have relationships with these people, you know. But not having that influence in her life,
mm-hmm.
she is sort of what you might imagine an undisciplined, rich girl turns out to be. She's spoiled, she's self-centered, she sees everyone sort of for her use, which is then why Mr. Knightley is so necessary for her, because he does in some ways act like a parent with her.
Yeah.
Not in like weird or inappropriate ways, but just in that he's willing to say, like, no, don't do that, or that's silly, or don't, you're wrong. And she does need that. She really needs that. Mm-hmm. But not having that mother figure, I think, is huge. It's said pretty early on, and then it's not really talked about much throughout the book. But I gathered that there was a kind of longing or a kind of hole in Emma, you know, that really was caused by the loss of her mother.
I think you're right, because Mrs. Churchill, was filling that gap. And
yes,
you know, she was brought in, she was a governess, and so she's doing the motherly things. But then what happened was Emma diffused her early on because she was not a match for Emma in wit or really anything else. And so Emma converted her from a governess to her friend and set them on equal levels. But even so, the loss that frames all the action of the story, which is losing her governess to marriage, tragedy, is evidence, I think, that even though she had brought the governess down to her level, there was still a sense of, but she's filling this role of this advisor that I need to have filled in my life.
That's right. Well, it's telling that Mr. Woodhouse mourns more in the book, mourns more for the loss than the loss of his wife.
Yeah, that's right.
It's never, right. Oh, well, your mother would have done this, or your mother. It's, oh, no, Mrs. Churchill would have done this and this and this. And yeah. And of course, every time the marriage comes up, oh, how unfortunate.
Yeah. And it's hilarious. It's like, oh, we've lost her. She's gone from, she lives a quarter mile away.
Right. Yeah. Your wife is actually dead. You did lose her. That other lady's, yeah, right down the street. Yeah. Yeah. But I do think the appearance, the novel certainly plays with appearances in some pretty interesting ways. You know, what seems obvious is never quite the case. There's that kind of anticipation she has for Mr. Churchill. It would sort of, on the surface, make sense, right, for them to get together. And of course, it doesn't work out. And he ends up going in a completely different direction. And you know, Harriet, she looks the part, but she's not really very intelligent. She's not a very strong person in terms of her personality. And yeah, so it always is kind of cutting against what things might look like.
That's right.
Sometimes in very predictable ways. I don't know about you. Well, I guess you watched the novel or watched the movie. I was able to figure out pretty early that Mr. Elton was actually in love with Emma.
Yeah. You know, I can't replicate what that would have been like, but as I was reading it this time, and it had been a long time since I read it, I was like, oh my gosh, like it's really funny because the author, the narrator is very careful to frame these things as this made Emma think that. To place that distance there between Emma's perception and what was likely really going on.
Yes. So when it's finally revealed, I was like, well, yeah, I mean.
Yeah. And I think that's fantastic writing, right?
That it is.
It seems like everybody else knew it too, right? Only Emma's in the dark about this. It's really good.
These are things that came out in the movie that helped me better appreciate it. Because it was like, as I was putting those pieces together, I just thought, oh, well, this is kind of predictable. But when I saw the movie and it is like, oh, yeah, he's making these clear overtures to her and she's just not even seeing it.
Yeah. She's so single-minded. We need to talk about the other really, really important moment in the novel. And that's when Harriet fixes her affections on Mr. Knightley. And it's important for plot reasons and blah, blah, blah. But there's a deeper reason why it's important. And that is Harriet is complete in that moment. Emma's work is done. Because she has made Harriet into a perfect mirror of herself. And so, of course, Harriet is going to fall in love with Mr. Knightley because that's the one Emma's supposed to be falling in love with. Everything about her is geared towards him and she hasn't seen it because of various reasons. But Harriet's falling in love with him is both the revelation, you know, just the jealousy thing that enables you to realize, wait, I want that person for myself. But deeper than that, this sense of, I've shaped her to think like me, and that's naturally led her to fall in love with Mr. Knightley.
Yeah, she's got a mini me.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it shows that Harriet really is pliable, I think. You know, she is impressionable. She
narrowly escapes. I mean, I shudder to think what her life would have been like if Emma had been successful in pairing her off with anybody.
Right.
In Mr. Martin, she has someone who is not going to try to shape her. And so she'll actually be free to be who she is, who happens to be the person he also loves.
Yeah. 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 It's kind of a good thing they all get married at once at the end of the novel, because it's every time Harriet falls in love with someone, something goes wrong.
Yeah.
In some ways, she's almost... too, I think she functions as kind of almost a scapegoat for Emma. I mean, she really gets the raw end of the deal so many of these times. And of course, Emma's sad about it, but it's like, I think it further highlights that in Emma's mind, you know, she is sort of expendable, or at least at the beginning she is. But you, I do feel bad for Harriet just because she does get the short end of the stick so much of the book.
That's right. Well, and that leads me to the biggest complaint I had about the novel. And for the most part, I'm not complaining. I think it's delightful. I love reading Jane Austen's prose, and I think it's funny as all get out. But this one thing bothers me. It's clearly a critique of this noble class and of these types of behaviors, and it's a critique of what Emma herself is doing throughout the entire novel. And she critiques it well enough that we can see what horrible disasters could loom. I mean, Harriet's poor life could have been ruined, absolutely ruined by Emma. But then none of the negative consequences really come about, right? Everything sort of gets smoothed over at the end, and it's sort of all's well that ends well. And that's great for the purpose of pleasing your writers so they want to buy the next book, but it does take the teeth out of the critique, right?
I'll push back a little bit.
Okay.
I think in a modern world, our modern world, when we have a critique of something overly romantic, the way that we often would go to the opposite extreme would be to maybe write a tragedy or something darker, right? Mm-hmm. It's not going to work out for the characters in the end. You know, it all has to kind of break down. The problem, I think, with the novel of Sensibility is its artificiality, right? It's not, you don't really see a human development in this story. It's just, like love at first sight kind of stuff, you know, everything is, they lived happily ever after, you know, these kind of ways of thinking. And while that may be present in Emma, I think that what you see in the way the novel ends is almost a kind of real Thomism, or it's like a real telos. You know, these characters get what they need. And so, yeah, it's a happy ending, but I don't think it's a sentimental ending.
I did not expect you to say Thomism.
Yes, I wasn't expecting to talk about Thomism in this episode. But I do think there is a real unfolding. You know, Emma doesn't just get with the person that makes her happy or that she sees as beautiful or, you know, that matches the part or looks the part. She's with the person she needs to be with in order for her happiness as a whole. Harriet is the same way. You know, she's with Mr. Elton. She's just she'll become a social climber. She's pliable, but she's with a man who really loves her and appreciates her. Mr. Elton, I suppose, maybe we could read his as karma more than anything, but still, I think there really is
fulfillment. They both have an eye to social status things, and they're both going to continue trying to improve their situation in the tiny ways they can, if nothing else, by criticizing other people. Yeah. And they're going to feel, you know, criticizing other people will make them feel better about themselves.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I do think that there's something deeper going on than just the sentimentality of that was common in some of those other novels. Like, I think in those other novels, you know, the characters would fall in love because they're beautiful and they, you know, there was that instant spark, but it takes Emma and Mr. Knightley a while. And that's good.
Yeah. And so to borrow a line from Tolkien's rendering of the Volsung saga, fate is strong to find its ending.
I like that. Fate is strong to find its ending.
Yeah. I suppose I was just thinking of it from the direction of, if I were a young lady of the time with proclivities, with Emma's disadvantages, would I really be dissuaded from acting in Emma's way by the novel? I don't know that I would. Well, I mean, I suppose it all depends on how greatly I felt the embarrassment of her lows, right? Because she does have to eat crow a couple of times, and it's quite bad from the standpoint of the society, and of her own self-image, these deep blows for her self-image. So maybe that would be enough. And at the end of the day, you know, it's really important that we say that Emma's not evil or wicked or cruel, really. She's not cruel because cruel requires intention.
That's right.
She's a child with too much power who's inadvertently hurting the people around her. And so, you know, we should pity her and love her. And part of that love is rejoicing that she comes into a situation where she can see her own mistake corrected and where she has the possibility. I'm going to correct myself earlier. I envisioned a dreary future for Mr. Knightley, but I forgot that the power of avoiding that lays entirely in his hands. Because what we learn from that first paragraph I read about Emma in the very first chapter is what she needs is not to have her own way. She needs a husband with a firm hand. And Mr. Knightley can certainly, and I think will certainly be that. And to me, that purchases the perfect happiness of the union that are the last lines of the novel. It's Mr. Knightley's own character and Emma's willingness to submit to him, which is really what it takes for them to get married at all, is for her to stop fighting and submit, right? I think that's what that couple needs to really be their best selves.
And I think there's a sense in which, and this is another difference, I think, between novels of sensibility and what Jane Austen's doing, which is that, you know, I think many of us have to be loved into being lovable. That's what Mr. Knightley is able to do, because he can see her potential. He can see her greatness, but he also can see then where she's not measuring up to that. And so he's pushing her forward into that. And we all need that. That's what makes a good spouse, not are they attractive or are they rich or are they powerful or whatever. That's not what makes a good spouse.
That's right.
It just so happens that Mr. Knightley is those things.
That's right. Both of them are, in fact, all of those things, but that's not the point.
Right, right, right. Because Mr. Churchill is those things. He's those things, maybe more so than Mr.
Knightley.
He's
richer, at least, I think.
Yeah, so...
I need to make sure that I don't get a bunch of angry letters. I would very strongly resist the generalization of what Emma needed in her marriage to all women.
Right, of course.
I'm not saying that women need a strong hand and a husband is going to control them. I'm saying that, you know, what the novel says is that Emma needed that. And Emma didn't have that, what happens is all of the couple hundred pages we just went through.
And for this reason, we can connect this back to Faustus, perhaps, which is to say, what was the first thing he asks for from Mephistopheles? It's to be married. And Mephistopheles says, no.
Yeah.
Don't ever ask me for that again.
Right.
That's the worst thing you could ask for, because because marriage has a way of making you holy.
Yeah.
And so we see that with Emma. This is what can happen with a good marriage with two of the right people, you know, there's this unfolding into a higher way of being. And so if Faustus had gotten that, you know, he may have actually repented at one point.
He certainly would have been harder to go gallivanting all over the universe with Mephistopheles, right?
That's true.
Mrs. Faustus being like, are you going to see the Prima Mobile again? I told you not to go see the Prima Mobile with that devil.
That's right. You missed dinner again.
That's right.
Perhaps one other thing we could talk about in the novel that we have not discussed yet is gender. In Jane Austen. And to go back to your point, you know, about whether or not a young woman of the age would have read this and changed her herself as a result, it's hard to say. I've never been a rich young woman. But I do think there's something about literature holding up a mirror to ourselves. You know, that's what good literature does. And so, you know, what the reader does with it is certainly, I think, up in the air. But I do think one of Austen's projects here, and you see this in some of her other works too, is she is critiquing some of the double standards of the day. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's interesting to maybe look at how this story and Pride and Prejudice are very similar, but a lot of the genders of the characters are flipped. So, for example, Emma is very much like Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice, whereas Elizabeth is a lot like Mr. Knightley, willing to tell the truth, willing to speak their mind, you know. Mr. Woodhouse is very neurotic, kind of like Mrs. Bennet is. There is no Mrs. Woodhouse. And while Mr. Bennet has some endearing moments in the novel, I mean, he is kind of a non-factor, you know, in the actual story.
Fairly absent. He just sits there and reads the paper.
Yeah. He's a cold and distant father figure. He's not really cold, but he is distant. you know, you also get Harriet, who's easily manipulated in some ways. I think she's a Mr. Bingley type. Mm. And so you do get some, you get some kind of scandalous behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, it is interesting to think about this. And I think many of those double standards, I mean, they've shifted some, but they certainly exist in our day. Mm-hmm. You know, the wrong choice or an unwise choice could absolutely ruin a young woman mm-hmm. socially.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when the young men mess up or when they do something, you know, there's always kind of a little grace there.
Yeah.
Mr. Elton, you know, totally misses, but he still gets another social climber. I mean, he kind of gets what he's looking for in yeah. some ways. So I do think that's interesting to point out. And I do think there's a lot of that going on in Jane Austen's work for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. And so what we're seeing, if we compare the two novels then, is there are some endemic vices of the noble class that are coming out. Pride and Prejudice being the top two among them, right? I think that is her best novel. And I think the reason it's her best novel is because she's speaking most directly to the central theme that she's is sort of talking about in all the novels, right? Mm-hmm. And so these things are endemic, but they show up, and because they're endemic, they show up throughout the class. And yes, in this story, it happens to be the case that the genders fell out this way, but there's nothing about the female gender that links it to right. pride or prejudice. You could see either one dominant in the individual. And so it is, I think, a very powerfully thought through decision to shuffle the genders around between the novels so that we get to see, look, I'm not talking about a feminine frailty here. I'm talking about a noble frailty.
Yeah. And it's interesting then, I think it makes that kind of critique of some of the double standards even more important, right?
Yeah,
that
right.
these are not, just like in our culture, I think we do the same thing, right? There are kind of two poles. There's, on the one hand, the idea that there is no such thing really as gender. And then on the other hand, there's a kind of gender essentialist mm-hmm. Perspective. And I think in some ways, those poles have always been operating. And so you see, I think in Jane Austen's culture, maybe more of a gender essentialist culture. So it's okay for a man to have those vices, but mm-hmm. not a woman, and vice yep. versa. And so I think her fiction functions as a vehicle to make that critique. Just like today, I mean, we do this. I mean, in some circles, you know, you'll the idea of what masculinity is really in kind of social construction, built on social construction. And so if you do something different, you know, well, that's weird, you know, it's unexcusable. But yeah. if you have the same vice that a man has, that's okay.
Yeah, it's at the risk of potentially, I don't know what you're thinking of for an inbred to death, and the risk of potentially stealing it. I mean, I think the Barbie movie is the really, really great example of what that looks like in our society mm. these days, where they invert the typical gender stereotypes. They present them and then they invert them by ways of showing how it's not just women who are hurt by these, but the men themselves are hurt by these. And mm. and this kind of inequity could happen the other way. And what would that look like? Right. So, yeah, I think that's a really good parallel you're drawing between the way their fiction goes about trying to address that and the way ours does.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've not seen the Barbie movie yet. Actually, I need Dude. To. I have seen Oppenheimer, but I've not seen Barbie. So, yeah, but I think that's important. And you do always get kind of in some cultures the ability to poke fun, right? Carnival,
mm-hmm.
the one day where everybody's allowed to kind of dress as the opposite or do things that were associated with the opposite. Was sort of a healthy introspection at the some of the cultural additions to masculinity and femininity. And these kind of things do not seem to be happening in Victorian England at the time Austen's writing. So her fiction becomes a vehicle to explore that a little bit. And yeah, it's very, I think, important and adds another dimension to the story that makes it, I think, more compelling.
That's a really fascinating takeaway, that Jane Austen's novels is a kind of literary carnival.
There we go. Write it up. There's a journal article. So... very good. Well, is there anything else in this work that we need to discuss, do you think?
We've checked off everything on my list.
Yeah, mine too.
All right.
Mine too. I think the more I've sat with it, the more I've appreciated it, but I'm also happy now we get to finally move on. So let's do end notes. What do you have for end notes?
Well, so my end notes are Ian Forster. I think Howard's Inn is particularly nice. And I'll tell you why I'm making that connection. I hadn't read Forster when I read Austin, and I read Forster subsequently. And when I read Forster, it felt like everything that I loved about reading Austin was there, the manners and the relations and all that other sort of thing. But it doesn't, you know, he's quite a bit later. We're coming into modernism now. It doesn't go to the happy ending necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of Jane Austen with a dark edge. And so if you read Austen and you enjoy her, then I think that you also would enjoy Forster. He's not, you know, it's not decadently dark in the way that modernism will turn into, where it's sort of dark for dark's sake. It's not that. It's just a bit of the things don't always end well. And to see what that might look like in similar sorts of situations, Forster's a great foil.
Interesting. I've never read that. I've read his Passage to India, which is good.
Also very good, yeah.
Yeah. That actually converses well with To Kill a Mockingbird, but that's a whole other episode, I think. Good. Well, mine is very boring. My end note is very boring. It's just the 2020 film with Anya Taylor-Joy. I thought she did a good job, and I think the tone of the movie was really helpful in understanding that this is a comedy, it's a satire. You know, I think the film of Pride and Prejudice are excellent and capture the tone very well, especially the Keira Knightley one. Mm-hmm. I think did a great job. This was very different tone wise in a good way. Mm. And Mr. Woodhouse, I forgot the guy's name, but he's in the Underworld movies. As the head vampire. I don't remember his name.
Oh yeah.
He's in Love Actually.
It's too. Bill Nye.
Yeah. Bill Nye. He's the father. He's Mr. Woodhouse, and he's fantastic. I think he's great. The guy that plays Mr. Elton is really funny. Very over the top. And it made me laugh out loud multiple times. So definitely helped me appreciate the novel better and see it kind of in the light I think that Austin wants us to see it.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Excellent. Well, listeners, thank you for tagging along with us on this journey. Our next book will be Lady of the Lake, which we're very excited to talk about. And it'll be a little bit of a change of pace from sort of Victorian era comedies. So we will see you next month. In the meantime, keep reading.